Karen Murphy was waiting for me outside the Madison. Karen and I were a study in contrasts. Where I am tall and lean, she's short and stocky. Where I have dark hair and dark eyes, she's got Shirley Temple blonde locks and baby blues. Where my features are all lean and angular, with a hawkish nose and a sharp chin, hers are round and smooth, with the kind of cute nose you'd expect on a cheerleader. It was cool and windy, like it usually is in March, and she wore a long coat that covered her pantsuit. Murphy never wore dresses, though I suspected she'd have muscular, well-shaped legs, like a gymnast. She was built for function and had a pair of trophies in her office from Aikido tournaments to prove it. Her hair was cut at shoulder length and whipped out wildly in the spring wind. She wasn't wearing earrings, and her makeup was of sufficient quality and quantity that it was tough to tell she had any on at all. She looked more like a favorite aunt or a cheerful mother than a hard-bitten homicide detective. "Don't you have any other jackets, Dresden?" she asked as I came within hailing distance. There were several police cars parked illegally in the front of the building. She glanced at my eyes for half a second and then away quickly. I had to give her credit. It was more than most people did. It wasn't really dangerous unless you did it for several seconds, but I was used to anyone who knew I was a wizard making it a point not to glance at my face. I looked down at my black canvas duster, with its heavy mantling and waterproof lining and sleeves actually long enough for my arms. "What's wrong with this one?" "It belongs on the set of El Dorado." "And?" she snorted, an indelicate sound from so small a woman, and spun on her heel to walk towards the hotel's front doors. I caught up and walked a little ahead of her. She sped her pace, so did I. We raced one another towards the front door with increasing speed through the puddles left over from last night's rain. My legs were longer. I got there first. I opened the door for her and gallantly gestured for her to go in. It was an old contest of ours. Maybe my values are outdated, but I come from an old school of thought. I think that men ought to treat women like something other than just shorter, weaker men with breasts. Try to convict me as if I'm a bad person for thinking so. I enjoy treating a woman like a lady, opening doors for her, paying for shared meals, giving flowers, all that sort of thing. It irritates the hell out of Murphy, who had to fight and claw and play dirty with the hairiest men in Chicago to get as far as she has. She glared up at me as I stood there holding open the door, but there was a reassurance about the glare, a relaxation. She took an odd sort of comfort in our ritual, annoying as she usually found it. How bad was it up on the 7th floor, anyway? We rode up in the elevator in a sudden silence. We knew one another well enough by this time that the silences were not uncomfortable. I had a good sense of Murphy, an instinctual grasp for her moods and patterns of thought, something I develop whenever I'm around someone for any length of time. Whether it's a natural talent or a supernatural one, I don't know. My instincts told me that Murphy was tense, stretched as tight as piano wire. She kept it off her face, but there was something about the set of her shoulders and neck, the stiffness of her back that made me aware of it, or maybe I was just projecting it onto her. The confines of the elevator made me a bit nervous. I licked my lips and looked around the interior of the car. My shadow and Murphy's fell on the floor and almost looked as though we were sprawled there. There was something about it that bothered me, a nagging little instinct that I blew off as a case of nerves. "Steady, Harry." She let out a harsh breath just as the elevator slowed, then sucked in another one before the elevators opened, as though she was planning to hold it for as long as we were on the floor and breathing only when she got back into the elevator again. Blood smells a certain way, a kind of sticky, almost metallic odor, and the air was full of it when the elevator doors opened. My stomach quailed a little bit, but I swallowed manfully and followed Murphy out of the elevator and down the hall past a couple of uniformed cops who recognized me and waved me past without asking to see the little laminated card the city had given me. Granted, even in a big city department like Chicago PD, they didn't exactly call in a horde of consultants. I went down in the paperwork just as a psychic consultant, I think. But still, unprofessional of the boys in blue. Murphy preceded me into the room. The smell of blood grew thicker, but there wasn't anything gruesome behind door number one. The outer door of the suite looked like some kind of sitting room done in rich tones of red and gold, like a set from an old movie in the 30s. Expensive looking, but somehow faux, nonetheless. Dark, rich leather covered the chairs, and my feet sunk into the thick, rust-colored shag of the carpet. The velvet velour curtains had been drawn, and though the lights were all on, the place still seemed a little too dark, a little too sensual in its textures and colors. It wasn't the kind of room where you would sit and read a book. Voices came from a doorway to my right. "Wait here a minute," Murphy told me. Then she went through the door to the right of the entryway and into what I supposed was the bedroom of the suite. I wandered around the sitting room with my eyes mostly closed, noting things. Leather couch, two leather chairs, stereo and television in a black glossy entertainment center, champagne bottle warming in a stand holding a brimming tub of what had been ice the night before, with two empty glasses set beside it. There was a red rose petal on the floor, clashing with the carpeting. But then in that room, what didn't? A bit to one side, under the skirt of one of the leather recliners, was a little piece of satiny cloth. I bent at the waist and lifted the skirt with one hand, careful not to touch anything. A pair of black satin panties, a tiny triangle with lace coming off the points, lay there. One strap snapped as though the thong had simply been torn off. Kinky. The stereo system was state-of-the-art, though not an expensive brand. I took a pencil from my pocket and pushed the play button with the eraser. Gentle, sensual music filled the room. A low bass, a driving drum beat, wordless vocals, the heavy breathing of a woman as background. The music continued for a few seconds more, and then it began to skip over a section about 2 seconds long, repeating it over and over again. I grimaced. Like I said, I have this effect on machinery. It has something to do with being a wizard, with working with magical forces. The more delicate and modern the machine is, the more likely it is that something will go wrong if I get close enough to it. I can kill a copier at 50 paces. "The love suite," came a man's voice, drawing out the word love into love. "What do you think, Mr. Man?" "Hello, Detective Carmichael," I said without turning around. Carmichael's rather light, nasal voice had a distinctive quality. He was Murphy's partner and the resident skeptic, convinced that I was nothing more than a charlatan scamming the city out of its hard-earned money. "Were you saving the panties to take home yourself, or did you just overlook them?" I turned and looked at him. He was short and overweight and balding, with beady, bloodshot eyes and a weak chin. His jacket was rumpled, and there were food stains on his tie, all of which served to conceal a razor intellect. He was a sharp cop and absolutely ruthless at tracking down killers. He walked over to the chair and looked down. "Not bad, Sherlock," he said. "But that's just foreplay. Wait till you see the main attraction. I'll have a bucket waiting for you." He turned and killed the malfunctioning CD player with a jab from the eraser end of his own pencil. I widened my eyes at him to let him know how terrified I was, then walked past him into the bedroom and regretted it. I looked, noted details mechanically, and quietly shut the door on the part of my head that had started screaming the second I entered the room. They must have died sometime the night before, as rigor mortis had already set in. They were on the bed. She was astride him, body leaned back, back bowed like a dancer. The curves of her breast made a lovely outline. He stretched out beneath her, a lean and powerfully built man, arms reaching out and grasping at the satin sheets, gathering them in his fists. Had it been an erotic photograph, it would have made a striking tableau. Except that the lovers' rib cages on the upper left side of their torsos had expanded outward through their skin, the ribs jabbing out like rabid snapped knives. Arterial blood had sprayed out of their bodies all the way to the mirror on the ceiling, along with gelatinous masses of flesh that had to be what remained of their hearts. Standing over them, I could see into the upper cavity of the bodies. I noted the now graying lining around the motionless left lungs and edges of the ribs, which apparently were forced outward and snapped by some force within. It definitely cut down on the erotic potential. The bed was in the middle of the room, giving it a subtle emphasis. The bedroom followed the decor of the sitting room. A lot of red, a lot of plush fabrics, a little over the top unless you viewed in candlelight. There were indeed candles and holders on the wall, now burned down to nubs and extinguished. I stepped closer to the bed and walked around it. The carpet squelched as I did. The little screaming part of my brain, slavishly locked up behind doors of self-control and strict training, continued gibbering. I tried to ignore it. Really, I did. But if I didn't get out of that room in a hurry, I was going to start crying like a little girl. So I took in the details fast. The woman was in her 20s, in fabulous condition. At least I thought she had been. It was hard to tell. She had hair the color of chestnuts, cut in a pageboy style, and it seemed dyed to me. Her eyes were only partly open, and I couldn't quite guess their color beyond not dark. Vaguely green. The man was probably in his 40s and had the kind of fitness that comes from a lifetime of conditioning. There was a tattoo on his right bicep, a winged dagger, that the pull of the satin sheets half concealed. There were scars on his knuckles, layers deep, and across his lower abdomen was a vicious, narrow, puckered scar that I guessed must have come from a knife wound. There were discarded clothes around, a tux for him, a little sheath of black dress and a pair of pumps for her. There were a pair of overnight bags, unopened and set neatly aside, probably by a porter. I looked up. Carmichael and Murphy were watching me in silence. I shrugged at them. "Well," Murphy demanded, "are we dealing with magic here, or aren't we?" "Either that, or it was some really incredible sex," I told her. Carmichael snorted. I laughed a little, too. And that was all the screaming part of my brain needed to slam open the doors I'd shut on it. My stomach revolted and heaved, and I lurched out of the room. Carmichael, true to his word, had set a stainless steel bucket outside the room, and I fell to my knees, throwing up. It only took me a few seconds to control myself again, but I didn't want to go back into that room. I didn't want to see what was in there anymore. I didn't want to see the two dead people whose hearts had literally exploded out of their chests. And someone had used magic to do it. They had used magic to wreak harm on another, violating the first law. The White Council was going to go into collective apoplexy. This hadn't been an act of a malign spirit or malicious entity, or an attack of one of the many creatures of the Never-Never, like vampires or trolls. This had been the premeditated, deliberate act of a sorcerer. A wizard. A human being able to tap into the fundamental energies of creation and life itself. It was worse than murder. It was twisted, wretched perversion, as though someone had bludgeoned another person to death with a Botticelli, turned something of beauty into an act of utter destruction. If you've never touched it, it's hard to explain. Magic is created by life, and most of all by the awareness, intelligence, and emotions of a human being. To end such a life with the same magic that was born from it was hideous, almost incestuous somehow. I sat up again and was breathing hard, shaking and tasting the bile in my mouth when Murphy came back out of the room with Carmichael. "All right, Harry," Murphy said, "let's have it. What do you see happening here?" I took a moment to collect my thoughts before answering. "They came in, they had some champagne, they danced for a while, made out, over there by the stereo, then went into the bedroom. They were there for less than an hour. It hit them when they were getting to the high point." "Less than an hour?" Carmichael said. "How do you figure?" CD was only 1 hour and 10 long. Figure a few minutes for dancing and drinking, and then they're in the room. Was the CD playing when they found them?" "No," Murphy said. "Then it hadn't been set on a loop. I figure they wanted music just to make things perfect, given the room and all." Carmichael grunted sourly. "Nothing we haven't already figured out for ourselves," he said to Murphy. "He'd better come up with more than this." Murphy shot Carmichael a look that said, "Shut up." Then said softly, "I need more, Harry." I ran one of my hands back over my hair. "There's only two ways one could have managed this. First is by evocation. Evocation is the most direct, spectacular, and noisy form of expressed magic or sorcery. Explosions, fire, that sort of thing. But I doubt it was an evocator who did this." "Why?" Murphy demanded. I heard her pencil scritching on the notepad she always kept with her. "Because you have to be able to see or touch where you want your effect to go," I told her. "Line of sight only. The man or woman would have to have been there in the room with them. Tough to hide forensic evidence with something like that. And anyone who was skilled enough, an evocator, to pull off a spell like that would have had the sense to use a gun instead. It's easier." "What's the other option?" Murphy asked. "Thaumaturgy," I said. "As above, so below. Make something happen on a small scale and give it the energy to happen on a large scale. Carmichael snorted. What bullshit. Murphy's voice sounded skeptical.